Learn how to shortcut your startup with Carter Ream.
You can test an idea very easily, right? For very little money, you can get a product, you know, a web page up and running. One of the things we talk about is flexibility is often underrated. So an example for us, in the old days when we had our liquor company, we decided we wanted it to, we were producing hundreds of thousands of bottles, glass bottles for our liquor. So we produced it in China. But what we quickly realized was, yeah, it was cheaper, but it was quote unquote more expensive because we lost our flexibility, right? We wanted to make packaging designs and it took us 6 months. Those 6 months where we had the old package, we were losing dollars, right? So we actually ended up moving our manufacturing to the United States, where it was more expensive, but we felt like we were buying back that flexibility, right? And so one of the things that we always encourage people, when you're in that investigation mode, try to figure out how do you just get 40 of your product made? Don't worry that at scale, you're going to make 1,000 or 10,000 or a million, right? But there's a lot of ways to investigate it. So one thing we talk about, this is kind of funny, they're kind of going up and down. So just so you guys know, it looks like slide starts here, goes there, and rolls up at the top. So yeah, just so you didn't think we were crazy. So one thing we talk about is know if you're a sailboat or a speedboat. So what we describe as a speedboat is a business like ClassPass, Uber, Postmates, right? You come up with an idea, you realize you have a good idea, you basically load your boat up with fuel, in this case cash, and you literally haul ass across the bay, hoping that you could gain market share, right? Because it's a winner-take-all market, you need a lot of capital. The challenge in a business like that is, if you don't get across the bay to the other place to fill up, you end up in the middle of the bay with a boat with no sail and you run out of cash. And a few years ago, we all just thought that fuel just kind of magically appeared. For the first time, entrepreneurs are suddenly realizing that fuel, or in this case, money and capital, is not as easy to come by. One thing we talk about is, right, most of the businesses that we hear about in TechCrunch, right? I think of TechCrunch, it's like People Magazine for tech, right? We glamorize like these guys and a unicorn and things like that. We glamorize a lot of speedboat businesses. Again, ones you read about, big unicorns, big amounts of money. Most of us, right, are going to actually run a business that's a sailboat business. So we use an example in the book of a sailboat business being a brand we invested in. Does anyone know the brand Kavita? Like a sparkling probiotic beverage drink. Sold to Pepsi for $300 million earlier this year. And we were early investors in it. And so it's a sparkling probiotic. So the story goes, my brother told me, hey, we're going to invest in this brand Kavita. And I said, what is it? He goes, it's a sparkling probiotic. And I go, what the heck is that? He goes, it's just like kombucha. I go, what the heck is that? And little did I know, kombucha would become the number one selling SKU at all of Whole Foods. So that's a good example of, it was a sailboat, right? It raised some capital, started doing well. It realized that the market was still developing, right? So it just kind of sat out there in the water with its sail up, increasing sales, increasing shelf distribution. And then all of a sudden, kind of kombucha came, right? This wave of kombucha where everybody, you know, assumed just because it tasted bad and had something in the bottom that it had to be good for you, right? So all of a sudden, kombucha sales go off the roof. And Kavita launched a kombucha flavor. And basically, it took them something like 6 years to get to 40 million in sales. It took them 1 year to get to 90 million in sales, right? So again, this idea of being a speedboat, finding the wind. So much of these businesses, there's a great presentation I saw recently, and it was talking about how so much of this is timing, right? And it was basically showing two companies both have the exact same idea. One was a little early on the wave, and it kind of falls off the wave. The other hit the wave perfectly, and it's a brand you know, right? And so much of it is timing. And so we talk about kind of being a sailboat, being out there, feeling the winds, but then trying to find that speedboat moment when you think you have something, right? It's time to kind of gun it and kind of start accelerating the pace. So that's the bottom of the slide before it. It gets even more complicated. So this is good. It's like brain teaser for you guys. So, and that looks like it was my notes too. So it's good I talked about Kavita. So again, speedboats, first mover, creating a trend, something like Lyft. And on the other example, something like Kavita. So switch up three, obsessively take advantage of your unfair advantage. So what we talk about all the time is, we increasingly, oh, perfect. This is going to ruin all the fun, but it will make it easier here, especially for photos. Yeah, perfect. Thank you so much. Oh, that was my fault. So again, obsessively take advantage of your unfair advantage. So we can increasingly live in an open source world. So the example I always use is Hyperloop. Elon Musk was too busy, so he tweeted out to the world blueprints for a Hyperloop, right? That is the ultimate outsource. And then it just became who could execute against that. So 5 years ago, there might be a shot that someone in this room had an idea that somebody else doesn't. Nobody in this room has an idea, I promise you, unless Zuckerberg's in here or anyone else, that a million other people don't have, right? It's, you're competing with someone that probably you went to college with, someone that lives in the apartment building, someone that lives in Asia, someone that lives in South America. And so really what we talk about all the time is, what is that unfair advantage, right? You have to obsess about what can you be world-class at it and try to double down. So take Books, for example, and we look at this all the time on investing. So Books, it's flower, kind of basically disrupting the flower space. It's done very well out of Los Angeles, which we are early investors in. So the co-founder of Books, his family owned all the flower farms in South America. That's a great company to invest in. They have to figure out the tech, but at least they have the supply chain all figured out, right? And so they have a huge advantage, right? We're trying to disrupt venture capital. That's kind of my day job in terms of kind of how we're trying to accelerate brands at scale using this kind of platform approach of repeatable behaviors. And I literally obsess, like, what is our truly unfair advantage? Try to obsess about that, build around that, double down on that capability, and then let the other stuff kind of go to the side. And like, I think it's important what we kind of put at the bottom is not all unfair advantages are obvious, but everybody has it, right? You read about Malcolm Gladwell outliers, right? Somebody that ends up disrupting some space, it was probably because, oh, their dad did something in that space, they were exposed to it, so they had innate knowledge, or they logged 10,000 hours or something like that. So truly kind of think about kind of what your unfair advantage is. So I guess this is a slide about us. Do what you do best and outsource the rest. So again, one of the things we talk about is there are so, and we try to do a good job of kind of outlining a bunch of the resources in the book, but there are so many ways to kind of plug in capabilities these days, right? So at Veeve, we immediately hired a bookkeeper and an accountant, right? When we started M13, our new holding company, we immediately went to a company called Propeller and said, you run our books, right? And it kind of goes back to the slide we just talked about. I don't have an unfair advantage in running accounting or books, so why should we do that? Let's let somebody that's world-class, Propeller, that happens to kind of power a lot of startups, let's let them do that, right? And so, again, one thing I think is, over time, as your businesses grow, if you become Uber or if you become Lyft or one of these, you'll kind of control everything. In the early days, right, what is it that's your competitive advantage? Make sure that's where your hires are, that's where your dollars go, and try to kind of outsource the rest because there are so many kind of different ways. So Daily Harvest, the brand I mentioned, they did over $35 million in sales in their second year, and they had one marketing person because they outsourced their growth hacking and their marketing to an outside kind of... Of course, now that they're big enough, they need to hire their own marketing team and their own growth team. But they got from zero to $35 million in sales with one marketing person, right? Because they said our capability, right, what they doubled down on was kind of the bigger marketing, the product roadmap, ideation. That's what they thought they were world-class at. And now over time, they're taking all those capabilities kind of in-house. This is a really interesting one. So people always ask us as investors, what do you look like for an entrepreneur? And I think one of the things that's changed a lot is, you know, it's always people, 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 everyone hears it. I truly believe the type of entrepreneur that's successful today is very different than the type of entrepreneur that was successful 5 years ago. So you look at a lot of the successful entrepreneurs, Travis from Uber being one of the most famous ones, they literally just had this blind vision and they're willing to run through walls to make it happen, right? That's why one of the reasons why Uber's been successful is Travis was literally willing to run through walls. On the flip side, right, one of the things is you have to be open-minded to change. And so what we talk about is as an entrepreneur these days, you literally have to have tunnel vision, but you have to be looking around while you're having tunnel vision, right? Because we'll talk about this example, but Slack started as a gaming app, right? They saw that people were messaging in the gaming app, and all of a sudden they said, oh, shoot, we need to double down on that, right? And they were kind of like a sailboat at the time, right? They already had the team. They already had the capital. They already had the company. And so they can do that faster than somebody else can. In the same way, did any of you guys know that before Instagram became Instagram, it was called Bourbon? So Bourbon, Kevin's original idea, was like a four-square check-in, share content thing. And then he very quickly realized, so he launched in stealth mode for about 4 or 5 months, and he very quickly realized, no one's engaging with the location-based aspect of it, but everyone loves this idea of sharing photos. And the photos are not actually even really about the place you're in. They're actually about what they're doing at that place. So he had this insight, immediately pivots to Instagram. And obviously the story goes, right, within 9 months, he had already sold it to Facebook. One thing that I think is really interesting is we talk about it a lot in the early days of scaling. So in the old days, you basically had what we called linear growth, right? You're trying to go from 2 to 5 to 10 to 20 million in sales. In the new days, right, if you think about that chart we talked about, you go from 2 to 30 to 70 to a heck of a lot more. And the way these guys get there is they have a dual mindset when they're starting off. They're both trying to maximize revenue and they're trying to maximize learning. And again, this is one of those ones everyone violently shakes their head when I say it, but nobody does it. And so what I mean is, if you're just, for example, say you're running an e-commerce company, if you're just trying to maximize revenue, you're going to use certain tactics with a very cheap CPA and things like that because you can maximize your dollars to do it. The problem is that doesn't scale, right? So one of the questions I always ask an entrepreneur, if I gave you $10 million right now, can you make this a $100 million business? And most people can't answer that because they go, oh, well, we're doing like a million in sales and we've done this. Versus the guys that do it really well, they basically have this dual mentality. They're trying to increase revenue, right? Because as you increase revenue, you get investment dollars and everything ends up well. But they also have this idea of like tinkering, right? They're always trying to tinker and find out what works. And when they find something that works, they literally turn up the dials and it's like a rocket ship. Again, Casper, ClassPass. If any of you guys are ClassPass users, one of the things you'll notice is here's a company that does a few hundred million in revenue and they're literally always tinkering, right? They're launching video on demand. They changed it from a certain number of classes a month to a token system. So they're always trying to tinker. And one thing that I always encourage our portfolio companies to think about is take 10% of your marketing budget every quarter and put it in a moonshot bucket. And so what I mean by that is, again, it's really hard when you're in the ebbs and flows and you don't have that much money and you're just trying to get to those revenue hurdles and you got investors and you want to make the slide better. You're always just focused about kind of linear growth, which is great in the short term. In the long term, it will kill you and you will die and you will lose to your competitors. What you need to find is step change growth, right? You need to figure out what is that thing that's going to create step change growth. And so the reason I encourage people to put 10% of their marketing budget every quarter into kind of like a moonshot pocket or kind of bucket is that it encourages the team to go, hey, we got 10% of our budget. Say our budget's $500,000 for the quarter. We got $50,000 in this bucket. And the team can sit around and just think about what should we try? And you really get to try these kind of moonshots or something like that. So I think that is really critical because that's how you're going to find your pivot. That's going to be how you find the data that leads to an insight like Bourbon to Instagram or Slack from gaming to messaging. And it's also going to be kind of what finds that kind of step change growth. Another thing we talk about is kind of, we say, think milestones and not time. So one of the things that these tech companies have gotten so good about is when they need money, it's like a badge of honor. It's because they've done something really well versus a lot of us in the old days, it was, shoot, we don't have money. We need more money, right? Or you think about, hey, you know, this year, I need this amount of money to last me 18 months, and then I'm going to get this much amount of money, and it's going to last me this, and so on and so forth. We see so many companies kind of do it, I think, the bottom way here, which is, for example, I saw a company the other day, it was, hey, we need this amount of money, and our goal is to get 2,000 customers. If we get 2,000 customers, then we're going to come back to you, and we're going to say we need $2 million. And then once we get $2 million, we're going to prove that, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that's how they scale. And I think it's just, again, seems one of those things that's quite obvious, but I think it is a nuanced thing in terms of it gets you to where you need to go faster. It really helps when you go to a VC and go, see, I told you I was going to need another $2 million. I need $2 million because I did something really well. And I, looking backwards, I did exactly what I told you I was going to do. And so, again, not think about it in time or dollars, but trying to think about kind of what success looks like. And so I always encourage people to, like, I was dealing with a company the other day and I said, okay, they're launching a new product. And I said, what does success look like? And they said, oh, we ordered 500 units of this. So we want to sell the 500 units. I said, well, okay, that's like one measure of success. But I said, you must have other measures of success, right? If you think about some of the things we just talked about, things like the fact that I said, you want to learn who your core customer is, right? Like, so try to say, hey, we want to sell 500 and we want to figure out who our customer is, or we want to make sure the AOV is this or something like that. Set that up because when it's measurable, what's measured is managed. And then when you get there, it's going to trigger, know already what it's going to trigger. So in that particular case, it was going to trigger, hey, we're going to need $2 million. We're going to do a sample run of X and XXX type of thing. And so just trying to think differently about that. I think one of the biggest friction points these days is obviously raising capital. And I think this is just, quite honestly, it's what VCs and investors like me like to see. And it will make the process kind of a lot easier as you're out there raising capital. So nail it before you scale it. This is kind of what we talked about earlier about the 1% difference. But again, when you look at all these things, this is what I was talking about. And this is basically, right, exponential growth. So slow, 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 and then an absolute rocket ship. If you had looked at, so one of our mentors is Kevin Plank, the founder of Under Armour. So he's quote unquote famous for it only took him 10 years to get to 100 million in revenue. Wow. Right now we do that in like 3.5 years, right? But he was famous for it only took him 10 years. If you would have looked at his chart, right, it's very much kind of linear, and it just every year he's kind of doubling, increasing 50%, and eventually gets to 100 million. So all the most successful companies, Honest Company, Casper, Lisa, Daily Harvest, all of their lines look like this. And again, it's not by accident, right? It's because they were slow, slow, slow. They weren't worrying about maximizing revenue, because if you're maximizing revenue here in the early days and you don't have a sustainable model, your CPA is too high, whatever it is, you can keep spending the money, but you're just throwing money away, right? And there was a time a few years ago where you could throw money away and just go and pick some more up at the store. Those days are long gone, right? The people don't do that. And so you can see, we said, take your time to refine your model. When you're ready, take the airplane to the top, kind of not the stairs. And so again, it takes a lot of discipline. It's one of these things when you sit here, you go, yeah, of course, this is what Dollar Shave did. But again, it's this mentality, it's this discipline to go, okay, so I was looking at something the other day, we nailed the CPA, right? We got the CPA where we needed. So we found the channel mix to figure out the CPA. Oh shoot, but we hadn't got the LTV right. We hadn't got the retention right. So there's this temptation, because the CPA was low, to just start pouring fuel on the fire of the CPA. But obviously, if you don't have the other side of the equation, right, you're just throwing away money that you could have had at a later date. So we had the discipline for this portfolio company to go, okay, we clearly don't have extreme product market fit yet, because we're acquiring customers, but they're not buying enough, and they're not buying enough over time. So we sat there for months and months and months and kind of figured it out, and then eventually, if we figure it out, right, then you can kind of pour the fuel on the fire. So having that discipline to kind of understand, kind of nail it before you scale it, go slowly, look for data points. It's amazing how many people I talk to. I was using this example the other day. They're like, oh yeah, we do A-B testing. Of course, right? Again, everyone violently shakes their head. A-B testing, we test different things. But then I said, so what's the strategy behind the testing? They said, oh, well, we're testing red versus green buttons today, and tomorrow we're going to test like $199 versus $299. And I was like, yeah, no strategy, right? And I said, what are your controls? What are you measuring against? And they're like, oh, no, we just tested red and green, right? And what do you mean tested against something? And so, again, thinking like what Dollar Shave or Honest or all these guys have done is they set out what they want to learn in the early days, right? They go, okay, we need to figure it out. Is our customer X or this? Is our price point this or this? Is our model subscription or one-time transaction? Whatever it is, they are very, 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 very conscious of knowing, like we talked about before, they have two objectives in the early days. It's revenue and it's learning. And I bet you if you ask Brian Lee from Honest Company and other successful guys that have done e-commerce, they'll tell you that if you had to force rank those two priorities, they probably would have put learning above maximizing revenue, right? They have a little bit of a luxury of those guys can get capital because they're successful entrepreneurs. I think for most of us, it's kind of a dual approach of both maximizing revenue and learning. But so many companies kind of forget to kind of maximize those learnings. And again, what I tell people all the time is like Daily Harvest. I was on Instagram on Sunday. I see two other companies that have literally just knocked it off that weren't around when we seeded Daily Harvest 18 months ago. And again, in this open source, ultra competitive world, if you're not acquiring your customers, somebody else is, right? Because there's four companies. If Dollar Shave isn't acquiring you to shave, then Harry's is. And if Harry isn't, then Gillette is, right? And so it's this competition. And so really kind of figuring out how to nail it before you scale it. Well, I guess I already talked about this, but I'm glad I have the chart in here. So this was the chart that we kind of talked about earlier. So this is the line, this blue line for top quartile. And this is the line for second quartile. So this is our 60 million versus our 12 million. But it is right. So we live in this world, right? 1% difference, 4 e-commerce stats, 400% increase in sales. And as Albert Einstein called the greatest invention of all time, compounding, that's literally the only difference between these, right? When you do the math, and we do the math in the book. So how do you get over that knowing that this is the case? I think part of it is we talk about kind of building a culture of this, what we call relentless improvement, right? You don't get from conversion rate of 2 to 3.5 overnight. It's every month just getting 10% better and 10% better and 10% better and 10% better. And so the one thing is the flywheel effects, the data that's out there, all these things compound, right? And so just trying to really obsess with how do I have my teams focus on this? How do we focus on this? Hey, if there's an area where you're weak at, right, where you're like, hey, I just can't figure out the 1% difference in this bucket, go out and try to figure out what's the resource, what's the mentor, what's the agency that can help you, because you need to figure out the 1% difference in all these things, and you need to do it quickly because the longer it goes, right, the one thing we talk about all the time in the book is time is the biggest cost that no one thinks about these days, right? If you had a great idea in the old days and you were a little slow to execute it, it was a forgiving world. If you have a good idea like Daily Harvest and you don't execute it quickly, you have 4 guys coming behind you that go, that's a good idea. I'm totally guilty of it. We're literally designing our holding company, M13. That was that logo that we saw a few slides ago that I didn't really talk about. We literally look for ideas and we just try to out-execute them faster because we have CMOs and growth teams and conversion funnels all set up. So we see an idea, they're trying to hire a bunch of people. We have world-class people. We can go and kind of outdo that, right? And again, we are not alone in that. Harry's just raised a lot of money to go after different brands, things like that. So trying to figure out how you can do that. And then also just, again, this understanding that a 1% better is really equates to 1,000% better. This one is a little softer. This is the kind of gain buy-in with the heart-based momentum and storytelling. One of the things that I think that you just can't underestimate is how important storytelling and brand is. So I was with someone earlier today, and they were talking about it, a VC, and they invest in kind of biotech and gut health and fertility and all this stuff. So these kind of weighty, heavily science things. But then they said what they always struggle with is these companies have this amazing science, and then they have to go sell to consumers. And there are a bunch of scientists and lab coats, and they're going, how do we tell our story? Versus, right, if you think about our friend Blake from Tom's, he's world famous for he told the story better than anyone, right? So you think about his story. He had, I think, 8 interns in his apartment in Venice before he had any dollars, right? He sold them the dream, right? He was a guy in his apartment in Venice. He sold them the dream. And you can see here, so this is 1985. People made rational decisions 75% of the time, and about 25% of the time they did emotional. And now emotional decisions 76% of the time and rational 25% of the time, right? And so again, think about it. There is a total sea of sameness. Everything looks the same. Why am I going to buy Daily Harvest versus all these other ones? Why? So the best example we talk about in the book actually is, did anyone here own a pair of Bob's? So Skechers, like any good big corporate company, said, holy cow, Tom's is on fire. This one-for-one model, they did it. And they thought to ourselves, we know what we're going to do. We're going to come out with Bob's. They're going to look exactly like Tom's. Exactly. We're going to make them for half the price because we have scale. And we're going to sell them at Skechers stores. And we're going to give a pair back. And we're going to make a lot of money. Do you think they were successful or not successful? Not successful, right? And everything sounded good in theory while they were in their boardroom in El Segundo. The only thing they failed to realize was this chart, right? Consumers are so smart these days. And again, they were cheaper, they were better made, they were from Skechers, but they didn't realize that people were buying Tom's because of emotional reasons, not rational reasons, right? And so again, these ones, like most things in our book, again, I'm not going to be the guy that's going to tell you revolutionary stuff. That was not our goal with the book, right? Our goal with the book was to get you thinking differently, right? To take all these good ideas or all these things we've seen from different brands and just kind of get you to kind of think about it differently. And so I think when you think about heart-based momentum or storytelling, it starts internally, right? That's why culture is so important, right? You need to be able to attract the best talent. So how do you do that? You got to get people to buy into your mission. You need to get suppliers to buy into it, right? You have to persuade the factory to make your goods and not goods for someone else. You got to get them to buy into the dream. You have to go to a retailer and go, oh my God, this is going to be the next big thing. And you got to get them to buy in on the dream. So on and so forth and so forth and so forth. And oh, by the way, that's all before you even get to the consumer, right? You have to do so much internally to be kind of selling that dream. And by the time you get to the consumer, you obviously need to be doing that. And I think I was with a VC today and they said, hey, do you know any good branding agencies or storytellers? And they said they have this consumer company up here in San Francisco and they're trying to do some branding. It's around a famous celebrity. But they said all these San Francisco firms, they just are so mechanical. Like they don't understand, like, again, I'm biased. I live in LA and this is our home, but they don't understand it like people in LA do. That is so much softer. It's so much emotional, so much about storytelling. They're kind of these kind of mechanical designers and things like that. So I think this is something you definitely have to kind of keep in mind. And again, it's very different. In the old days, consumers bought because yours was cheaper or yours was better. Now they don't do that, right? And one of the things that's great about all the digital media and social media is there's so many kind of layers of the onion you could peel back. So with our alcohol brand, we had this whole idea around a better way to drink. It was kind of better ingredients, better type of better cocktails, and then better for the world, 1% for the planet. And at the time, we were trying to be like a Warby Parker or Tom's, or not at the time, but the whole time, like a Warby Parker or Tom's of the alcohol industry. And one of the things we struggled with before digital was we couldn't tell everyone our story because we were using more traditional means, a billboard. We couldn't be like, hey, it has acai, it's better, it makes better cocktails. And by the way, we're better people that do better stuff for the planet. That was too much, right? In today's day and age, you think about the customer journey, you can really get them on a lot of different places. So you'll have, you know, if you think about it, some of your customers that will just buy it. But then there'll be the subset of customers who will go to your social media, and your subset of customers who will go to your website and read more, and your subset of consumers that will do about video. And right, you have the ability to talk about a lot of different things. You know, you might be, if I'm a brand, for certain things, I might use video and I might want to educate them about product attributes. I might understand by doing kind of some of the testing we talked about earlier, for this consumer, they don't care about product attributes. They just care that we're good people or they care about our mission. So I can do some really fancy targeting and go, for you, I'm just going to show videos on our mission. But you want to know what's in our ingredients. You go to the gym and you want to know, like, are our vegetables as good as they are or whatever, right? And so this ability to kind of make sure we do that has never been kind of stronger or better. And then this is a big one that we talk about is, and nobody likes to kind of hear this, but we talk about it a lot. So success doesn't equal a successful exit. So my brother and I ended up selling our liquor company successfully to a big multi-billion dollar strategic, but we tried to sell it once before, about 18 months before we sold it. And we realized everybody said to us these words, man, I'm so impressed with what you've accomplished. You guys are so smart, but it's just not for us. But I don't get it. Everybody says the same thing. Man, it's so impressive what you build. I love it. Blah, blah. You're so smart. I left the room with my chest up high. And then I'd go, gosh, darn it. What's going on? Nobody wants to buy this. What I realized was we didn't give these guys a reason to buy the brand. And this, I'll kind of talk about specifically kind of when you're trying to get someone to buy the brand, but I think there's a lot of different output, you know, kind of outcomes or exits. So, right, for a lot of people, the exit of your brand or your product or whatever you're doing is going to be a very large corporation, right? A lot of people believe because of the flywheel effects of data and platforms and network effects that we're going to live in this world where we're going to have very big kind of trillion-dollar companies that are going to control a lot, right? Take Instagram and Facebook. If you or I bought Facebook or Instagram for $1 billion, people would have shot us, right? Facebook can buy it for $1 billion when they did, because they have the flywheel, the network effects, the platform effects. You know, today Instagram's probably worth probably $100 billion within Facebook, right? Because of, again, all these effects of kind of having data and consumers and things like that. And so I always encourage, like, there's a brand in LA that we're helping advise, and they do $85 million in sales, and nobody wants to buy it. And they've never raised money, they're dropouts out of college, they've done an unbelievable job, but their goal is to sell it, and they can't get anyone to sell it. And I challenged them, and I said, well, why would somebody want to buy it? I said, well, dude, we do $85 million in sales. I said, but the guys that you want to buy it do $4 billion in sales or $10 billion in sales or $20 billion in sales. You think they care about $85 million in sales? Like, No, it's like a tax bill for them, right? And so I said, what is it that you have that they want? So we did some brainstorming, and I said, different possibilities are new capability, right? So if I'm a traditional retailer, a traditional company, I might buy an e-commerce brand like Walmart, right? The first brand we ever invested in was we seeded Bonobos. So Walmart bought Jet.com and they bought Bonobos because they wanted to buy digital capabilities. Walmart also needed, they couldn't get smart digital guys to work for them. So they bought Jet.com and Bonobos. So sometimes it's a capability. Sometimes it's your HR talent, right? All of us are only as good as our HR talent. Sometimes it's that you reach a different consumer that they currently reach. Sometimes it's a price point thing. When we sold our liquor company, we were kind of a super premium brand, and this particular brand had kind of middle to lower price products. They wanted to become premiumized, so we are the premium thing. Sometimes it's brand. I was talking to a brand the other day, and they said, again, they're trying to sell to someone big. And I said, I think somebody would buy you for brand because they would see how strong your brand is. So what we always tell people is think about what do you have if you're selling to somebody. It could be a big company or small company. What do you have that they need? Okay. So that's the first step. Figure that out. Then once you figure that out, make decisions through that filter about 2 years leading up to a potential sale. So for example, if you're doing $5 million in sales or $10 million of sales or something, and you think your acquirer is going to buy you because of brand. Say you have $1 million. What are you going to spend $1 million on? Building your brand to make it look bigger than it is, or trying to drive another $1 million of revenue? I think everyone's nodding for building your brand. So, right, you would of course build your brand because whether you're doing 5 million or 6 million in revenue, if that's not what they're buying you for, they don't care, right? But making your brand feel bigger if that's what they're doing. Or this brand might say, oh, you know, we reach this millennial female consumer around health and wellness. We know that's a really attractive consumer. So I know if I had $1 million, if I was all about maximizing revenue, I might try to sell to you, and maximize revenue, retargeting or different things. If I know someone's going to buy me because they like my female millennial consumer, I'm going to spend all my money trying to target you three, right? Because that's the person I want, and I want to be able to show this acquirer type of thing. So I think there's a lot, and that's obviously specifically, you know, why does Pepsi buy Kavita? Why Unilever? So like I had breakfast with the CFO of Dollar Shave Club the day after Dollar Shave Club got sold to Unilever. And I said, so what was it like that eventually got the CEO of Unilever to buy Dollar Shave Club? And he said, basically, he was blown away by one thing. He was blown away by the product innovation kind of cycle that they said that they launched a shampoo for $25,000 in marketing. And what he was basically saying was, and he was blown away because when they launch a new shampoo, they have to spend $5 or $10 million because they don't have a direct relationship with their customer, right? They go through retailers and other gatekeepers. Dollar Shave said, oh, we know who our customer is. Everyone on here is on our email list. We'll just email everyone, right? And so they're able to drive the first few $1 million of sales. And basically, they could cover the inventory and the cost to launch a SKU by what that initial kind of order would look like using their customer base. So they love this idea that they could succeed quickly and fail quickly. Unilever, he saw that data and he's like, I want it. And at that point, once somebody wants something you have, they will pay whatever they want, right? Whether it's Casamiga Tequila, where they wanted George Clooney, or whether it's Dollar Shave Club or something else like that. And so again, I'm talking very specifically just because it's the example up there in terms of selling to an acquirer. But I also tell people, and we talk about in the book of, before you start your idea, kind of do an exercise of what success looks like, right? We glamorize all these big exits and these big companies, and somehow we've gotten into this world where raising a ton of money at silly valuations is like this badge of honor. Man, if you can not raise money, if you can build a brand and sell for $100 million, whatever, millions of dollars, a million, $100 million, whatever it is, that's most often better than the alternatives, right? And not every business needs to be built to sold, right? I use an example, I think we talk about in the book. We were looking at two different brands that reach $20 million in sales. One of the brands does $20 million in sales and does $7.5 million in profit at a big retailer. It's been built to be profitable. It's been built to kick off cash. That guy lives in a really nice house, nice car, eats a lot of Toro sushi. Life is good. Then I saw a brand the other day, $20 million, They've raised $10 million in capital. It took them twice as long. And the issue is they're trying to build a $100 million brand. They got stopped at 20. That is a crappy brand, right? Now they're losing money every year because they built this brand as if it needed to be a $100 million brand. When they could have said, hey, $20 million brand, $5 million brand, $30 million. Doesn't matter the number. I use kind of fake numbers. That's a great business. And so trying to think about what does success look like, both from a personal thing as well as a market size. Again, there are so many ideas that I look at. I'm like, this is not a $1 billion idea. This is not a $100 million idea. Ah, it's a great $10 million idea. So if you build it to be a $10 million idea, it's a fantastic outcome. If you build it to be $1 billion and you end up at 10, the math usually does not work out very well. And so I think thinking of that from the early days, and then once you're kind of towards the finish line, making sure you think about how do you package this up? How do you sell it? Whether it's M&A, whether it's an IPO, however you kind of want to exit the business. Oh, and that's my last one. So yeah, so I think hopefully what you take away, and then we'll, I think the mic is if anybody wants to ask questions, is again, I don't never claim to walk up here and get people to go like, oh my God, my mind exploded. This was a bunch of stuff that you never heard before. I think what we try to do is just get wheels turning.